Hey, everybody. Welcome. This is Micha Sifri with the Personal Democracy Forum Network. Welcome you to our ongoing series of talks with movers and shakers and thinkers in the field of technology and politics. Again, want to thank our sponsors, AT&T and the Bivings Group, for helping make this possible. Today, we're very pleased to have with us my good friend, Allison Fine, who is an author and an activist and for many years been very active in the field of nonprofits and measuring their impact. In a previous life, before she started doing online work, she was actually the founder of the Innovation Network, InnoNet, and also the former CEO of the Evolve Foundation. She may be best known to you now for her book, Momentum, which is subtitled Igniting Social Change in the Connected Age. And she is now working on a very interesting book with her co-author, Beth Cantor, who many of you may know or you should know is another expert in this whole social media space. And what Allison is going to be talking with us about today is actually part of this research in progress for the book that she's writing on return on investment from social media. And I think it's important to understand that we are, you know, kind of all in this conversation together. This is a very new space. There's a lot of activity and a lot of people who are experimenting with moving their organization from essentially being a static, shall we say, Web 1.0 operation that at best use the web as a place to hang your digital shingle with a very static kind of brochureware website and maybe run an email list and not necessarily do much else. And I think a lot of people today are looking at all sorts of reasons to become more social, more engaged with members. And the big question is, can you prove that it's valuable? How do we know if it's having an impact? So those are the topics that Allison is going to tackle. And for the first part of the call, I'm going to hand it off to her really to just give us a presentation walking through her slides, and I'll try not to interrupt very much. If you have questions, we do have the chat that's enabled. We're also following the chat that people may use if you're using Flickr. Which is the hashtag is PDF Network. So you can also raise questions there if you're having trouble with the in-house chat. And without further ado, I give you Allison Fine.
Thank you very much, Micha. It is a pleasure to join you today and share some thoughts. And I really do want to reiterate with folks that what I'll be sharing today is are some ideas that are in process. For Beth and I, as we've been thinking about this, this is the first walking of this idea out into a little bit of a public, and so I'm really looking forward to sharing what we have, but moreover, need your input and your help in thinking this through as well. One of the things that Beth and I have been really thinking about a lot is the fact that return on investment is too often seen as solely a financial measure, which may work well in the corporate sector, but doesn't work well where Micha and I live, which is in the advocacy and campaign worlds, that our efforts are intended to have a social return, and that's fundamentally different than looking at how many cars were sold as a result of an effort. So it makes it, I think, more interesting what we're talking about. It's a richer way of looking at measures. We'll get into that in a second. But it's also harder. And it's harder because we're going to move into looking at what the value of building relationships is to an organization. And much of that can't be quantified. You may have seen efforts where people try to quantify some of that. You could say, you know, the lifetime benefit of a donor to an organization is going to be X number of dollars. One could do that. I think it's a stretch, and I think it unravels you in a lot of unnecessary formula, but I do understand that there is pressure from senior staff, from board members, from donors for results, and so I thought we could talk about how to talk about those results in a bit of a different framework. So as you can see from this slide, we're building on work that David Armano has done. He's got a terrific presentation up on SlideShare called Listen, Learn, and Adapt. And Beth on Beth's blog has been thinking and writing about this for a while, and Katie Payne is terrifically thoughtful on it as well. If you are interested in financial ROI, Dag Holmbo has a blog post. It's a series of blog posts. There are three right now that have equations as to how to come up with the financial return on social media, and so you should feel free to look at that. I hope that one thing that you'll hear from me today is that, and this happens so often in social media, none of this is a zero-sum game. I'm not saying that we should only look at non-financial returns or other people who say we should only look at financial returns. We need to look at both. What I'm trying to do today is level the playing field a bit because the financial ROI tends to drown out other voices in the conversation. So we want to move beyond those Web 1.0 hits and clicks, as Nika mentioned, and we want to move to a framework that is really very agile, quick learning, quick adjusting process of learning how you're doing and improving, not only for a current campaign, but to inform future campaigns as well. So let me show you this. Katie Payne came up with a really terrific ladder of engagement that she talks about, and this is from a corporate perspective, that you're trying to gather attention, that's engagement, move to relationship building, that's what we do when we have conversations on Facebook and on blogs and other places, that's all about building relationships, and ultimately the end goal for a corporation is generally selling something. You're trying to get somebody to buy something or to be eyeballs on a screen somewhere. Beth and I took that equation and turned it into this rather rainbowish look at a different kind of progression that we felt fit social change better. And I'd really love to hear from people about whether this works. But let me walk through it because it's a little...
Just a quick interruption, Allison.
Yeah, sure.
So people know whether they need to take detailed notes. Will these slides be available after the presentation? Will we be able to post them along with the podcast?
Oh, absolutely.
Great.
We can post them on SlideShare, wherever you want. So.
Excellent.
Okay. So the one thing that we want to make clear is that listening, that purple box, is not just a step. The squiggly line is to infer there that listening happens throughout an entire learning process. It is more of the connective tissue than a single step, and it is a good first way to start for organizations that are having some difficulty figuring out how to dip their toe in. I was having a conversation with a communications director for a very large foundation a couple of weeks ago, and they're really struggling. They've been a fortress, as foundations can be, because there hasn't been an incentive in the past not to close the windows and the doors. And we began to talk about listening, which I'll talk about on the next slide a little bit, about going out and trying to get a handle on who's talking about your issues and what are they saying, and a whole bunch of different channels. And his response was that he had started to do that, and nobody was talking about them. And there was a long pause and this dawning recognition on his part of the fact that that was really bad, that nobody was talking about them. But we want people to build in listening throughout the entire process. Listening then creates an opportunity to start to build your networks again on multiple channels. You might be on Twitter and on Facebook and using blogs and using websites. Nobody is going to know what channels work best for your issue and your campaign. That's going to have to be some experimentation. When those networks are built, we want some relationship building to happen there. That creates social capital. And social capital creates social change in the real world. So let me go into more detail on these. And we can start with listening. I was just reading a terrific story. A good friend of mine is Carrie Lewis. She's head of, she's the internet marketing manager for the Humane Society of the U.S. And the summer of 2007, she actually just started in 2007. In 2007, you might recall, that summer, the biggest story anywhere was Michael Vick being indicted for dogfighting. And Carrie's a really good listener. You know, she really understands the need to use a variety of different tools like Google Alerts and Technorati and RSS feeds and, you know, who's using what tags on Delicious for a certain issue. And so, you know, it didn't take a great listener to hear that story explode, but she really took great advantage of it by quickly building a YouTube campaign to respond to all the outrage around that, particularly for their issue, which is animal cruelty, and to quickly listen to the outrage and feed into that anger and that energy and to build a YouTube campaign for that, which allowed them to really build their network. They were already set up on a series of different channels. They already had a Facebook cause. They were... Twitter wasn't of interest yet. They had their own blog and had good relationships with other bloggers. And Carrie could see immediately a huge surge in their network as it was building, in part because of the issue, but also in part because of the relationships that they had already spent some time in developing. So she, on a regular basis, Carrie is using Google Analytics and using, you know, measuring the authority that their blogs have on Technorati, which shows the number of people who are linking to your blog. Now she also uses Twitter followers to see that growth as well.
Excuse me one second.
Yeah.
There's somebody who just unmuted their phone. If you could make sure that your phone is on mute, please. Go ahead, Allison.
Sure. And all of that listening and listening and relationship building creates something that is absolutely critical to social change, which is social capital. I'm sure folks have heard about, you know, remember Robert Putnam's book, Bowling Alone. It was all about the loss of social capital in American communities. We've seen over the past, I'd say just in this century, basically the Web 2.0, the history of the Web 2.0 world, that what happens when people really connect in meaningful ways is a surge in social capital. And social capital is defined as an increase in trust and reciprocal relationships. So Carrie blogs about somebody else's cause today, knowing that at some point down the road, it doesn't have to be next week, but at some point that trust and that relationship is created that gets her a return blog down the road. And Carrie could see through their efforts with this YouTube campaign, let me actually find the name of it. It was the Knockout Animal Fighting YouTube Contest, bit of a long name, but they could see that all of those relationships that they had built with other bloggers, with their own email list, and again, we're not talking about, you know, email continues to be very important. It's not irrelevant at all. That they had built up an enormous amount of influence in the social media space for their cause. And ultimately, all of that building adds up to social change. Social change is when people out there, whether it's online or on land, are doing things for your cause, doing however you have designed your cause, and that good planning still needs to happen, they're doing things on your behalf. They're signing petitions. They might be voting if it's a political campaign. They're emailing friends. They're self-organizing, which is really wonderful to see. And so I should have added a slide here, Mika, on measuring all of this. So we've seen the listening and the measuring is happening all along. You know, you have your listening for how often your cause is being talked about by people. You're certainly paying attention to what the traffic is on your cause. And then you're measuring whether these activities that add up to social change are happening as well. I was having a conversation yesterday with Scott Berman. I don't know if he's on today. I hope he is. We were having a very interesting conversation. His group helped to organize the Malaria No More campaign that folks probably heard about in the last couple of weeks. It was just enormous. There was a Twitter contest with Ashton Kutcher about that as well. And, you know, one of the stopping points was they could see if there was a message to donate here, you can see what the result of that is. People click and they donate. But if the message was click here to follow us on Twitter, it was difficult to draw the connections between that campaign and the huge surge in Twitter followers, because in addition to what they were doing with social media, there's a huge surge of mainstream press attention to it as well. And here's one of those issues where I don't know that social media, that measuring social media is ever going to be as easy as looking at Google Analytics. There are still times where we're going to need to use old-fashioned measuring tools. And in that case, that would have been taking a random sample of new Twitter followers and simply asking them where they heard about the campaign and what compelled them to click and follow. So that was a long way of saying we have new tools for listening and measuring, but we also need to do old-style measuring as well, like doing content analysis of comments on blogs and on YouTube, where you could say, look and see the number of positive, negative, and neutral comments and what messages were moving people to action. And then ultimately, when you really do get to social change and that goes on land, then you're back to what I would call a more traditional evaluation framework of using surveys, using focus groups, using interviews to assess how and why people were moved to act for your cause. So, Michal, I think I'll stop there. I know that was an awful lot. I'd love to take people's questions.
No, that was great, and I didn't want to interrupt you because it was flowing well. I have a starting point question, which is, the example you gave us with the Humane Society was, and the malaria issue, I suppose, maybe is different. But in the case of the Humane Society, you were saying this is a case where when your issue is hot in the news, that's when the social media opportunity, you know, the cost of not doing social media is going to hurt you in a way. Is there a benefit, if you have limited resources and you're trying to convince your executive director, we've got to be doing more in this space, is there a particular benefit to doing it around those episodic moments of high attention? How do you make the argument that this is where people should put scarce resources?
That is the $64,000 question for a lot of organizations. The interesting trend this year, Micha, is that even those organizations that have been scared to death of social media are dipping their toe into it. I think we've hit a tipping point that you have a cause on Facebook, you have a Twitter account. Those are just becoming like turning on the lights and having a telephone for groups. I think the case needs to be made for folks that if you wait for an explosion like the Michael Vick event, if the Humane Society didn't have their channels up and running already, they would not have been able to take advantage of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the listening piece. You know, that's the being in the space all the time and being ready to move is so important. What Carrie can show from their experience, both good and bad, 6 months, here's a really interesting story, Micha. 6 months after the Michael Vick campaign, Humane Society joined America's Giving Challenge. This was a matching grant program started by the Case Foundation of who could create the most friends, mainly on Facebook, over a 50-day period. And Carrie thought, well, we've built up our email list, we've built up our friends, we're really good at listening, we're learning from, based on that Michael Vick episode in large part. And she said, I'll just, as in her own words, I'll just push the button, and will do really well in this challenge. And she pushed the button 2 weeks into that challenge, and nothing happened. It was like the light didn't turn on.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't turn on because, you know, it really takes relationship building and conversations to get people excited about participating with you. So she could certainly show over the course of the Michael Vick campaign that the ability, the relationship creating that they were doing was leading to a much higher number of people clicking on their site, capturing those emails, which they do have a financial equation that, you know, that will create donations down the line, as well as a much, much greater reach in the blogosphere. And so, you know, that case can be made of the value of those relationships.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do folks have questions? I want to start to open things up to the people on the call. What you just have to do is unmute yourself and speak up, say who you are, and ask your question. Hopefully we won't have a gigantic crowd all at once, but feel free to jump in. What if you're listening, Allison, and, you know, you do that first step of listening, and what you hear isn't silence, but it's negative?
Yeah.
What kind of, I mean, you were telling us about a foundation executive who didn't hear very much.
Right.
And thought that was worrisome. But, you know, what if there's hostility out there?
Right.
What is, I mean, is that a bad thing, or is this actually important?
Oh, I think it's terribly important. You know, Beth has a line in a blog post a couple of weeks ago of you have to listen for the good and you have to listen for the you suck, you know. I was having a conversation with a head of philanthropy for one of the largest left-standing banks a couple of weeks ago, and she said, we can't go out there. You know, people are screaming hateful things about us. And so here's the decision to make. They're saying those things whether you're listening or not. And so that's your choice. If you know, you can choose to ignore it and pretend it's not there, or you can choose to engage in the conversation, and it will be difficult to begin with. It will certainly be difficult if you haven't built up any relationships with people to get to understand you better and to know your cause better. And so it will feel uphill for a certain period of time, but the only opportunity you have to make your case about your cause, your campaign, your institution, is to participate in the conversation. Those are where staff are going to have to really work hard for some patience on the part of either senior staff or boards or funders to look for smaller victories in this. You know, one of the things, and this is the difference, for instance, between that we were saying when Humane Society was able to take advantage of the Michael Vick situation, not with a huge campaign, not with big multi-channel, you know, millions of dollars. It was actually started as a rather small campaign. So if people are saying very negative things about you, you want to look for those smaller spaces and an opportunity to build relationships and have conversations that can then ripple out as growing influence. But you have to start with smaller expectations for that and smaller campaigns.
Okay, so we have a question from Karen Dietwiller. I don't know if I'm pronouncing her name right. Karen, are you on the call? Do you want to voice it yourself?
Well, I can try. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay, good. I had the phone on mute and just had to unmute. I'm concerned that in institutional life, organizational CIOs and other people who control infrastructure may look at case studies like the Humane Society as a way to say that this technology is just a fly-by-night technology. It's one of those see-I-told-you-so kinds of scenarios. They put resources into setting up the infrastructure. It looks good for a short period of time, and then when the first real test comes, as in the challenge that you were talking about, then suddenly there's a flat response. It doesn't look effective. By conventional MBA criteria, that suggests that it was a brief flash and not something that's sustainable or important. How can we best anticipate those kinds of responses, work through them, and also get the resources to focus on sustaining the relationships, not just sustaining the connectivity or physical presence? So that's really three questions in one.
And an entire book in and of itself, Karen.
Yes, I'm sure so.
So, listen, but the situation is real. I understand that. And here's the good news. The good news is that there are a growing number of case studies that are in MBA language that will show your green eye shade people the financial value to organizations about this. I happen to know one that is in the nonprofit area, but if you go on to SlideShare or you Google social media ROI or the that fellow's blog that I said at the beginning, there's a growing amount of material that tells you that investing in marketing this way, in getting your cause out there this way, has a financial return, A, and B, is much less expensive than traditional media. So, for instance, SeaWorld of San Antonio ran a social media campaign to get people to come to their new exhibit, which is called Journey to Atlantis. This is last summer. And they went out through their blogs, they, you know, built those relationships, they got links to their site, they did a lot of Facebook connecting. And at the end, they were able to say, they had a survey company when the exhibit opened that went through the crowds and had people take surveys as to where had they heard, you know, what had motivated them to come, where had they heard about the exhibit. And they found that it was, it was 30 cents for a new person who came in through social media and over $1 for people, the cost to get people in who had heard about it on TV or newspaper, right? So there it is, point blank, that this is a very effective and inexpensive way of working. The harder case to make internally, Karen, is that this is not campaign to campaign. As you mentioned, there is maintenance to be done with the relationships between campaigns. This is the conversation and the listening that happens all the time. And that does take institutional support. But what you can also show, this is why I think that Humane Society, the two stories about Humane Society are so important, which is to show that the first case with Michael Vick went so well because they were so ready to do it. They had set up these channels and they were doing all their good listening and talking and having conversations with people before they launched the campaign. And they didn't do that good warming up and getting people ready for the giving challenge, which didn't go well. Does that help?
One of the things also with the giving challenge, Allison, isn't it clear from the people who did do well there that it was the causes that had the greatest personal sort of involvement of whoever the leader of the cause was did the best?
That's exactly right. The pushing the button to send an email for the giving challenge was a terrible disaster for groups who just did that. The groups who did well, I just finished an assessment of it. What was fascinating about it was that the winners who got a lot of money from the Case Foundation were groups that almost nobody had heard of. They were groups that had no staff, and what they had was a core group of 10 to 20 people who worked 24/7, got very excited about this, reached out through all of their multiple channels, and a viral effect happened because of that. Of that last slide I showed about social change, all those things happening out there on behalf of the cause that the cause didn't have to do, that's where you get huge cost savings too, right? So this is the difference. Every time that you air a TV commercial, your organization pays the same amount for that, right? Every time someone else online talks about your cause, there's no incremental cost to that. And that's when you, once that happens, once you get that second degree of connection and leveraging, then you're off to the races with all sorts of fun things.
I think there was a question from Evelyn Jane. Is that, are you on the call, Evelyn? Want to unmute? Okay, I thought she had raised her hand earlier using the dashboard. Karen, did Allison cover the question for you?
Yes, I think that was a terrific answer.
Okay, terrific.
Nico, this is Karen Jagoda.
Go for it.
I was wondering, Allison, great presentation. I was wondering what your feeling is about ads on social network sites.
Yeah, this is not my area of expertise. Micha, do you want to take that one? I think you know sort of Google Ad World better than I do.
What is the question, Karen?
Ads on Facebook or MySpace, you know, the sort of variation on the blog ad theme. So you're not just having a social presence. You're actually advertising in the social network.
Right.
Does that sort of dilute the message? Is that a good way to reach the right targeted audience? And I see more of that coming. I'm just wondering if you think it's effective for accomplishing what you're talking about, which is that relationship building.
Oh, well, let me start, Micha, and you hop in because you do know this area better than I do. But I have something to say, which is from what I've been seeing, and, you know, Google is giving – it's like $10,000 worth of ad revenue to nonprofits who apply to them, and something like three-quarters of those nonprofits apply for it, get it, and then don't do anything with it. And what I have seen is that it takes some elbow grease to figure it out well, to figure out what keywords work well for people and what their ads should say to make the click-throughs work. But it seems to be worth the investment once you put that energy into it. Is that what you're seeing as well, Micha?
Well, what I was going to say, first of all, was that the topic of this call is social media, not paid media. And we did have a call with Josh Koster. We have another one coming up with Eric Frenchman, who each have real expertise in this question of, you know, spending your scarce dollars online to target particular audiences, either with messages or direct asks. And I, you know, what little I've heard about Facebook is that the paid advertising doesn't seem to work very well there. And there may be people in the marketing business who would make a different argument. And at some point, I think we'll try and get somebody from Facebook on to speak to that question directly. But my impression is that people are using these social networks, be it, you know, Facebook, MySpace, or, you know, microblogging sites like Twitter, to socialize. They're not there to be marketed to. So, you know, the advice I tend to give is you have to rethink your cause as the thing that people want to talk about rather than the thing you have to interrupt people to talk about. And by and large, paid media is still about interrupting people, and maybe some of it, you know, the use of contextual advertising is a little bit less annoying because, frankly, if you are a person of a particular background or interest and you're signaling that by Facebook, maybe you do want to see ads for, you know, that same topic. But I want to steer us back to the main subject here, which is in the social media space, which is the place where people are living out their social lives online and organizations are trying to figure out how do I move my cause or my campaign through that environment and what are the ways to judge whether we're having an impact. Is that okay, Karen?
Will you take a new question?
Yes, we will take a new question. Who's this?
Thank you. This is Odile Weisenborn with Riptide Communications.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if you would be able to list specific actions that PR firms should take to see a return on investment from adopting social media?
Could you tell me a little bit more when you say adopting social media? You mean building a campaign for a client? Can you give me a...
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, so what I'm hoping we come out of this conversation with is a new understanding that, so can you give me an example of a campaign that you might build for a client?
Sure. For example, working with a client, a nonprofit client that's trying to build awareness of its mission, that's trying to promote its mission, an example of using how we can use social media.
Yeah, right. Okay, so I think one of the shifts that I think we're seeing is, you know, if we were talking about this 10 years ago, you would build a campaign and then launch the campaign through paid media, you know, magazine ads and TV ads, and, you know, have some metrics that you were using to see the number of people who use a code that you put out or a variety of things and sort of cross your fingers and let it go, right? And so now there is an opportunity to, I think, create first a conversation about whatever this cause and campaign is that you want to launch. So instead of building it first and launching it, having this pre-launch conversation that gets people engaged in what you're trying to do. And it also helps you to figure out what channels are working well for you and your cause. I was just talking the other day to folks who are working to stop the death penalty. And they have found that, you know, Twitter is just not working that well for them right now, but Facebook is really exploding. And there's no way to know that except to go out and experiment a little bit. So it's an opportunity before, you know, the campaign is put to bed, you know, put all together, to all buttoned up, to have that conversation and to broaden your social network, to figure out what tools and what messages work well, and to engage people in it. Then to, you know, move your campaign out and build within it opportunities to learn very quickly and to adapt very quickly. So you don't want to let a whole campaign roll out and then at the end point say, how did we do? Because you have this opportunity with social media to know in real time how you're doing and to adapt to it, you know, to find that one message is working better or one channel is working better and, to, you know, move your resources there. So at one level, certainly you want to take, you want to be looking at your, what I would call attention getting stats, right? How is traffic going to your website? If you're using Google Ads, you know, what's gaining more click-throughs in that? If you're blogging, when and how are you getting traffic? More importantly, who is linking to you on your blog? That's very important. Then you want to move to relationships. Who are we building relationships with? Who's talking about us? Who are the influentials in this particular issue area that talk about this issue that we need to build a relationship with or who are on board? That would be huge. You know, if you could just have five bloggers talking about you, but they may have huge audiences that, you know, so you don't have to create those huge audiences. You're leveraging those relationships. And then finally moving to the campaign outcomes themselves. Are people doing what you hoped would happen through this campaign? You know, are they donating money or walking or cleaning up parks or whatever it is that you set out to do? You want to make sure, so you want to make sure that you're learning continuously and often. You're adapting your messages and your channels to what you're learning from people, and that you're looking at all of those different levels of results, not stopping at just attention, but really getting all the way to social change results. Does that help?
I'm not really clear. I mean, the name of the meeting was Return on Investment from Adopting Social Media, and I'm still sort of not really clear exactly what it means, adopting social media. I'm going from my limited knowledge of what that means, and that's why I wanted to tune into the meeting. But, I mean, you're talking about blogging,
mm-hmm.
you know, encouraging, I guess, bloggers to talk about campaigns, but I'm still unclear on what your definition of adopting social media is.
Well, so social media are a whole host of tools that allow people to interact with one another. So before, if you were just using broadcast media, that's a one-way conversation. You broadcast something and everyone listens to it passively on their couch. Social media provides the opportunity for people to have a conversation about a cause, and that could be through email or Facebook or Twitter, right? A whole host of different ways of having that conversation. And the way to influence a conversation is to build relationships with lots of people who will then do things on your behalf, right? So you want, if you have a blog, you want people reading that blog, but more importantly, you want other bloggers linking to you and helping to get your message out through their blogs as well. So there's a geometric scaling of your message and your actions through all of these different kinds of tools.
I would, if you don't mind, interrupting, Allison, I often ask people, what would you rather have, an email list with a million addresses on it, or 10,000 bloggers, each with an average of 100 daily readers blogging about your cause?
Mm-hmm.
And the conventional answer, I think, is, well, of course I want a million email addresses. And I think, obviously, we're not in a world where you have to choose between one or the other, but the value of having 10,000 bloggers, there are a couple of different values. There is the fact that we are drenched in marketing messages already, and so the one-way form of communication is getting less and less effective. And I include in that just the sort of, you send an email, fewer people are opening emails, fewer people are clicking through. So, you know, you have to, it's hard to keep that email list as big and as effective as you would like. A blogger who has 100 readers, that may seem like nothing, but in the aggregate, that blogger and her 100, you know, loyal readers, they're probably paying more genuine attention to what she has to say than that sort of impersonal email message with the same message. Multiplied by 10,000, you're also reaching a million people. But here are some of the other benefits of working in the social networking space. If a few of those bloggers do something stupid, say something dumb about your cause, whatever, they alienate a few people. If your email list, the example I used to give is, and the person who signs the email list for you is Bill Clinton. But, you know, if one day Bill Clinton says something stupid in the news, it happens.
Let's just say.
Your list is no longer worth very much with his name on it, at least for that, you know, period in time. You're dependent on this one very key node, you know, the person signing your email. If 5 out of your 10,000 bloggers go on a vacation, it doesn't matter. You have this resilient network. And then lastly, and, you know, Allison didn't really talk about this other return on investment, but I think it's really important in this day and age to remember that if people are not discovering you through search, if Google does not return your name or your organization high up in the list of results when people go searching about a cause or a topic, it's as if you don't exist online. And so there is a necessity element here of being involved in the online arena where people are going to be linking back to you so that you'll do better in search. And if you, you know, so to me, it isn't just are people talking about you online, but is Google pointing to you online? And a very big return on investment now is simply doing better in Google search, because you will discover that will generate more traffic organically to you, more people who are looking for you. And they're far fewer are going to find your website on their own, but they will find it through things like Google.
Good point, Mifa. Thank you.
Other questions?
Thank you.
We have a question here from Evelyn Jane Williams about, she says she's working to launch a social solution for the military and wondered what the experts that have been involved in these types of efforts thought may prove valuable and successful in this realm. Gee, Allison, do you know anything about social media and the military?
No, I don't.
Evelyn, we will have to find you some suggestions of experts. I don't know if anybody else on the call wants to jump in, but that's a blind spot for me, too. I apologize. It's a good question. Other questions? A very thoughtful and contemplative group who does not have questions. Allison, tell us a bit more about the book that you're working on and, you know, sort of where you're putting your research energy.
Oh, sure. It's called, the tentative title right now is called The Networked Nonprofit. And the idea is to try to move nonprofit managers from thinking about managing organizations, which is what we were brought up to do, mm-hmm. and instead to move to managing networks, networks of people, networks of organizations. So it's really trying to help people to rethink everything they've been taught about creating silos and competing with other organizations and branding and return on investment is just financial and all of these habits that we've developed. In some part, we've developed them because of the great influence of corporate sector thinking in the nonprofit sector over the last 15 years. And in some ways, we've developed it out of fear. Fear of this new social media world, kind of closed, it circled the wagons in some ways. So a couple of the areas that, in particular, we really want to rethink is, one is this return on investment area. Another is governance. You know, governance, we've been using these models of boardroom governance for hundreds of years now, and they don't work. You know, when you look at the data of what boards are what executives hope boards will do and what boards actually do and who boards are made of, which is still white men who are lawyers and bankers and who those organizations serve, there is these growing chasms between those, you know, groups of 20 people and organizations doing real work on the ground. So thinking about, well, could a board be a broader social network instead of this closed little group, and what would that look like? What would it mean? Is another area that we're really trying to dig into. But I went out 2 weeks ago, Micha, and tried out that idea of networked governance with a group of senior managers of human service organizations. And they were outraged by it, so it didn't go well. If he could throw tomatoes through a webinar, they would have done it, I think.
Really?
It was very funny because a few of them said as we moved along and it got tenser and tenser, and they said, well, if you were just talking about programs, I understand the need to work in networked ways. You know, we understand the need to have conversations on Facebook and on Twitter and to get more people involved. But once you move to governance, it's just too scary. And I said, what is it about the word governance? What does it connotate that makes that so scary? And I said, well, you know, they can't touch our mission or something. It was just a terrifying
very threatening.
For them. Very, very
what?
Threatening.
Somebody's got music on in the background. I would appreciate it if you'd mute your phone. Karen Detwiller just wrote, Dr. Mark Stavish of George Washington University just did a great dissertation on leadership in nonprofit boards, a former VP of AOL, and on hospital boards, who might be a good resource for your new book. Thank you, Karen. Just to continue on this, is there an example of a networked nonprofit that you know, what falls in that category? Who's doing that in your view?
Well, certainly one of the groups that is just been fabulously successful the past year and a half is a group called Charity Colon Water.
Mm-hmm.
They're based in New York. I had never heard of them before Twestival, and I've been in doing this work for a long time, you know, which is very interesting to me because it's like the results of the Giving Challenge as well, that these very small groups, sometimes even unstaffed, have been fabulously successful using social media. It really levels the playing field in a lot of ways. So what Charity Water does that I think sets it apart from a lot of other groups is, one, they're very, very transparent about how they're working. So if you go to their website, they've got their financial statements up, their tax returns are up, their board minutes are up, their strategic plans, I think, might even be up as well. So you get a very good sense that they're not holding anything. Everything is up and it's open. The other thing they do is they are on a lot of different channels. They're very active on Twitter, very active on Facebook, and engaging lots of different communities in conversations about their issue, which is creating wells and clean water, or providing wells and clean water filters in third world countries. And perhaps the most important thing is they let people go. This is the pushing the power to the edges piece. We talked about, I used the word leveraging before. So I know you're going to have Amanda Rose on in a couple of weeks, and she's really fascinating. She is the one of the three organizers of Twestival, which was a worldwide day of fundraising for Charity Water. And, you know, so you have an organization that didn't need to control the message or the messengers and let it go on Twitter and let lots of people be involved, and it developed into this amazing worldwide event on one day. And that would have been very, very difficult for traditional organizations to do.
But it's not. So it's Charity Water that's the nonprofit, not Twestival itself.
That's correct. Twestival is a fundraising mechanism.
Mm-hmm. Do folks have any reactions to this? I mean, I find it fascinating, but we could have a whole other conversation about just what the network nonprofit could look like. Curious for some feedback from people on the call. Don't be shy.
This is Mark Ross. How you doing?
Good. Hi, Mark.
How are you? I'm working with two charities right now, nonprofits, one focused on Leon and one focused on childhood obesity. And, yeah, we're implementing a lot of these tools. It's interesting because we just went through the presentation process and got them on board. I don't really have much to add other than, you know, Charity Water is quite interesting. And I find it interesting. It's been very challenging to pitch these organizations that aren't immersed in this. They know they need to be a part of it, you know, but it's almost the baby steps of getting there up to speed is a bit challenging. At the same time, there's so many new sites, so I don't really have a question. I was just going to say that the case study aspect of these different things I find really interesting. There could be more sharing on these, you know, where people are having success or failing or, you know, just different ideas. I think it'd be really helpful.
Can you tell me where and how are you getting traction with folks? Because you go in and people are scared and it's new and they know they should be doing it, but they don't want to do it. How have you found to break through some of that fear?
I think the biggest selling point is that I try to talk about these things as tools, right? Not just that they're all tools. You know, and you don't have to use every one.
Right.
There's a lot of different social media sites that do something than others. And I think the biggest selling point is saying, listen, if it doesn't work, it's a big deal. You know, our barrier to entry is so low, there might be a slight time commitment to be willing to kind of accept failure and take the risk. Almost what you were talking about earlier, how you need to listen.
Right.
In some ways, I find that's been, at least I think, the selling point. You know, what I'm trying to say is I haven't been so rigid telling people, listen, you have to do that. In some ways, I'm saying, you know, I think there's some core platforms out there, but at the same time, I think we should experiment with some other ones.
That's right.
You should play where your people are, you know, not where you think they are, so to speak. Just kind of let the group, your users, kind of take the content where they want to go.
I think that's so smart because, you know, particularly for folks who are new to it, you can really lower the risk factor by, one, saying how, exactly as you do, how inexpensive entry is. And also just finding those small places to experiment, keeping those expectations down, and to say the purpose isn't to grow, you know, a network of 100,000 people in the next 2 weeks. We would love if that happened, but it's probably not going to happen. The purpose is to figure out how we do this, right? How we develop a voice using these tools, where we're getting traction, and you know, how to expand from there, and that seems to ease the pressure on organizations a lot.
Mark, could you, we didn't get your whole name.
You sure, it's Mark Ross, R-O-S-S.
And who do you work with?
I have two projects. One's called Second Six, and one's called Amplifico. Amplifico is more focused on kind of nonprofit public policy.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to second your suggestion that we need to do more case studies. Wherever possible, and point to other people who are doing case study kind of work. And you know, Beth and Allison are, you know, very much immersed in that discussion now. I think what we have to admit that we are really in a space that's in transition, and where there's a lot of experimentation going on. Some really interesting kinds of developments, like the Charity Water example that Allison gave. And that this has to really be a continuing conversation As we're running down on time here, before I do my closing sermon, is there one last question that somebody has? I heard somebody's phone perhaps unmuting.
It's Chigoda again. I'm coming up across this question of who's qualified to comment on things and who's qualified to participate in the discussion. And I'm wondering if part of the solution here might not be building in some kind of moderation so that you sort of soothe the egos of the people who think they know it all, and you also allow enough people in who have good ideas and new ideas. I think if we could figure out a way to overcome that obstacle, we might reduce some of the resistance.
That the resistance of the decision-makers within an organization, Karen?
Yeah. Or, you know, the people who are running foundations or running these nonprofits, they think they know all the answers, and you just need to follow what they're telling you to do. And so they're nervous because they like peer-to-peer review. They want people who are on their level commenting on their ideas or helping to promote something. And some of that resistance, I think, is based on this kind of arrogant ego thing that kicks in, because they don't, all voices aren't equal. So there might be just a way to overcome some of that by having some stepped process, or I know it's like not what we want to encourage, but just as a way to sort of encourage people to become more part of this, to allow there to be different layers. Does that make any sense?
It does make a lot of sense, and I know this is a very difficult transition for people who are accustomed to having more control than they're going to have in this Web 2.0 world. You know, one great irony I see when I go into organizations is those groups that are most afraid of using social media are the ones who are most likely to put the interns on it and let them go on Facebook, right, sort of unmoderated. I think that there is a balance that can be struck. It doesn't have to be the wild, wild west out there. For instance, you can require civility on your blog comments and so on. But I think it's very, very important that senior managers participate in these conversations, otherwise they never will value it. And they just need to be handheld a little bit to get there.
I also think that one of the examples I've come across is people just have to experience this rather than project their fears, right? There are fears like, I won't have the time, this is just going to make my job more burdensome, and, you know, it's a fad. Why are we bothering? I know when the Washington Post started including links from bloggers on articles by reporters, the first reaction of the reporters was, who let the riffraff in? You know, why are we giving away valuable space to people in their pajamas? And after about 6 months, the tenor of their response turned to, I got more links to this article than you got for your article. It became a competition among the reporters, you know, to see who was doing better because bloggers were finding their articles interesting. So sometimes it's really, you know, and this is another example of, we need these kinds of stories. We need writers like Allison and Beth to be collecting and distilling these stories. And I guess we have to keep having these conversations here in the PDF Network and, you know, on personaldemocracy.com, on the blog, and, of course, at the conference. So it will be continued. We will get Allison's presentation deck up on SlideShare, and we'll link to it from the PDF Network homepage, where we will also archive this podcast. I want to thank you, Allison, for giving of your time and your expertise, and thank everybody else who's been on the call. Thank our sponsors, AT&T and the Bivings Network, and we will see you again in 2 weeks for the next in these series of calls, and I'm going to just quickly tell you who is coming up. In case you are wondering whether you should be signing up, we added Amanda Rose from Twestival, who will be speaking on June 4th. But 2 weeks from now, It's how the Pickens Plan recruited 1.5 million volunteers in 9 months. And this is actually really a great follow-on to today's conversation because we'll be able to go really in deep on how one new cause organization that was entirely built on using social media has been able to recruit millions of volunteers to its issue. So look forward to seeing you again in 2 weeks, and in the meantime, we'll see you online. Thank you.
Thank you for having me, Micha.
Our pleasure. Take care, everyone. We'll see you again soon.